Welcome to Nightlights. This is David Brent Johnson, and for the next hour, we'll be playing music performed at one of jazz history's most legendary night spots, the first integrated club in New York City, and talking about it with cultural historian Michael McGurr and author Terry Trilling Josephson. It's Cafe Society, the wrong place for the right people, coming up on this edition of Nightlights.
Thank you.
Trumpeter Frankie Newton's band swinging the house at Cafe Society in February 1939 with their version of Honeysuckle Rose from the document CD Rare Live Cuts. New York City, 1939. It was a year in which the city looked to the future with wonder at the World's Fair and with growing anxiety at the specter of war in Europe. The Depression still lingered, while Hollywood had one of its greatest seasons ever, releasing films such as Gone with the Wind, Ninotchka, and The Wizard of Oz. And in Lower Manhattan, a former shoe salesman named Barney Josephson was presiding over the city's first integrated nightclub, Cafe Society, a club he'd started with a couple of small loans and an intense, groundbreaking vision. Josephson's comedians and MCs were edgy, unusual young talents like Jack Gilford and Zero Mostel. His decor was provided by Manhattan artists who painted lavish and satirical send-ups of high society life on the walls. His musical acts were often suggested by John Hammond, the young aristocrat who would help elevate the careers of performers from Billie Holiday and Count Basie to Bob Dylan and Bruce Springsteen. His politics were Popular Front, the broad leftist coalition of the 1930s, and his guests at Cafe Society ranged from Paul Robeson and Langston Hughes to Dashiell Hammett, Nelson Rockefeller, and Eleanor Roosevelt. Students, labor leaders, and jazz lovers were also among its devotees. How did this place, this charged and lively gathering of artists, intellectuals, entertainers, and urban denizens, come to be? In the early 1930s, Barney Josephson had traveled throughout Europe, going to clubs and cabarets in Berlin, Paris, and other metropolitan centers of the continent. Josephson's widow and co-author of his memoir, Cafe Society, The Wrong Place for the Right People, Terry Truling Josephson, on how that trip helped inspire Josephson's vision for his club.
You see, the influence of the cabarets in Europe, where they did have social comment, where they did have great music, where they did have sketches, and Barney took that a step further, in a way, by bringing in all various kinds of the arts.
Harlem Review shows and speakeasy culture also influenced Cafe Society, but it was free from one notorious influence that pervaded many New York City nightclubs, Terry Truling Josephson.
Most of them were really run by the mob. Barney's was not. It was one of the few places. And I'm talking about places like the Stork Club and so on.
Cafe Society's most unique feature, its most revolutionary act, was its policy of integration, not only for performers, but for the audience as well. Cultural historian Michael McGurr.
Even though New York City wasn't segregated in the way that the South was then segregated, even though African Americans had the right to vote in New York City, unlike in the South, despite all of that, the entertainment world was an unequal world, a world that put African Americans in their, quote, place pretty decisively. Cafe Society, the club, broke with that very self-consciously, making African Americans not only the stars up on stage, but also making them equal in the audience in a way that they'd not been before.
Barney Josephson was a great lover of African American music, and with John Hammond helping him, Cafe Society became a showplace for many musical sounds. One of the most prominent in its early years was Boogie Woogie, the up-tempo, rollicking, bass repetitive piano style. Here's blues shouter Joe Turner, a Cafe Society regular, accompanied by three of the most prominent practitioners of Boogie Woogie, all of whom appeared frequently at Cafe Society as well, doing, appropriately enough, Cafe Society rag on Nightlights.
Society is the theme. Helen Norton gave it the lover's name. Swing it, boogie, swing. Old feet jumping all around. Boy, just tearing it down. Swing it, boogie, swing.
Mm-hmm.
mother. Old Albert, really all right. Swing it tonight. Swing it, boogie, swing. What's the theme? Yeah, me, tidy. Shake that thing, swing it, boogie, swing.
Big Joe Turner with a triad of boogie-woogie pianist Albert Ammons, Mead Lux Lewis, and Pete Johnson, all of whom performed at Cafe Society. Barney Josephson was interested in presenting more than just music at Cafe Society, cultural historian Michael McGurr.
It would be fair to say that Cafe Society was probably the first politically correct club in the United States. That's what it was. It had a particular political agenda it expressed in every aspect of its being. Made fun of the wealthy, so when you came in, there was a doorman wearing tattered gloves, a kind of elegant costume, now run down, there in the middle of the Depression, mocking what had happened to the rich. You had waiters in tails who originally were supposed to mock the customers. In fact, the practice stopped because the waiters were uncomfortable with this reversal, but that's what Josephson wanted. He had murals on the walls painted by artists he'd brought in that depicted realistic scenes of working class life in Depression America. So when you looked around you, you were reminded of social reality. He had these African American entertainers who were given status they didn't normally get. So in every way, it was about a certain kind of politics, a certain kind of cultural politics.
Pianist Teddy Wilson was a politically involved artist and had already been in one vanguard of jazz integration, playing in Benny Goodman's Black and White Quartet of the mid-1930s. One colleague later remembered him as the Marxist Mozart. Wilson had recorded frequently with Billie Holiday in the mid to late 1930s, then gone on to form his own big band. When the big band failed, Wilson took a small combo into Cafe Society. Here's that group with a studio recording of I Never Knew on Nightlights. pianist Teddy Wilson with the small group he took into Cafe Society in 1940 doing I Never Knew. Wilson's small combo jazz was just one of many musical styles that patrons encountered at Cafe Society. Cultural historian Michael McGurr.
Cafe Society had so much political and cultural significance that you can almost miss just how great the music was. Josephson, advised by Hammond, had an incredible array of musicians who were really quite extraordinary, had a very mixed musical policy, probably mixed more genres, more styles of music than any other club in New York at what was a very rich time musically. Boogie-woogie piano, mainstream swing music, small bands, big bands like Count Basie, solo singers such as Billie Holiday and Lena Horne, a folk musician like Josh White, a blues shouter like Big Joe Turner. Nobody quite did that, and nobody brought it off so well, and nobody in the process made such a powerful point about the richness and diversity of black culture.
All aboard!
The Golden Gate Quartet, a gospel group that Barney Josephson featured at Cafe Society with Gospel Train, a concert performance from Carnegie Hall in December 1939. As further evidence of Cafe Society's wide array of musical styles, Josephson also frequently booked a young African-American woman pianist, Hazel Scott, who played both boogie-woogie and jazzed-up classics. Here she is doing Rachmaninoff's Prelude in C-sharp minor.
Thank you.
pianist Hazel Scott, a Cafe Society regular, performing her version of Rachmaninoff's Prelude in C-sharp minor, one of her famous Swinging the Classics numbers. Two performers who played key roles in Cafe Society's first year of existence were singer Billie Holiday and trumpeter Frankie Newton. Newton is one of the most mysterious and underrated musicians of the swing era, a talented painter and alleged Communist Party member who led the house band at Cafe Society throughout much of 1939. Holiday had made a series of brilliant small group recordings with musical cohorts such as pianist Teddy Wilson and saxophonist Lester Young, but she still wasn't all that well known outside New York City. Her stay at Cafe Society would change that. First, let's hear a rare live recording from Cafe Society of Billie Holiday and Frankie Newton together doing I'm Gonna Lock My Heart and Throw Away the Key on Nightlights. Billie Holiday and Frankie Newton, a politically engaged trumpeter who led the house band at Cafe Society for much of its first year, in a live performance from the club of I'm Gonna Lock My Heart and Throw Away the Key. Billie Holiday played at Cafe Society throughout most of 1939. Like other artists Josephson booked, she was given a long and ongoing gig, unusual by most nightclub standards. It was during this stand that she began to do a song that would have a significant impact on both her career and her audiences at Cafe Society. The song, Strange Fruit, was written by a man named Abel Mirapol, who would later adopt the orphaned children of Julius and Ethel Rosenberg, the New Yorkers executed in 1953 after being convicted of atomic espionage. Strange Fruit was a haunting, devastating indictment of lynching. Writer Michael Denning calls it a popular front cabaret blues, but it gained a broader significance as a prototype civil rights anthem in a time when anti-lynching laws couldn't even make their way through Congress. Michael McGurr.
Strange Fruit really is unique, not only because it's probably the only political song that Billie Holiday performed in her long career, it's unique too because there really is no best-selling predecessor to that song. There's no really angry song about blackness in the world of jazz. There's Black and Blue by Andy Razoff, What Did I Do to Be So Black and Blue? There are songs about the history of African Americans by Duke Ellington, such as Symphony in Black and Creole Rhapsody, but they don't have lyrics and they are not, they couldn't really be characterized as angry music. So Strange Fruit was something new.
Strange Fruit became a sensation, so much so that Josephson even took out ads in the New Yorker simply stating, "Have you heard? Strange Fruit Growing on Southern Trees, sung by Billie Holiday." Strange Fruit would be named decades later by Time magazine as the song of the century. When Holiday sang it at Cafe Society, audiences sometimes applauded wildly, sometimes sat stunned in silence, sometimes burst into fits of anger or weeping. "The polite conventions between race and race are gone," New York journalist Samuel Grafton wrote of the song. "It is as if we heard what was spoken in the cabins after the night riders had clattered by." Terry Truling Josephson on how Barney Josephson presented Billie Holiday's performance of Strange Fruit.
What he did was stage the song in such a way that Billie, there were no lights except for a pin spot on Billie, just her face and down to her bosom. And all was dark in the room. Nobody was allowed to order any drinks or any food. The cash register was quiet. This was the song that would be featured this way.
Holiday's 1939 studio recording of Strange Fruit, recorded for New York City's small Commodore imprint because her main label did not want her to do the song. Whenever Holiday performed the song at Cafe Society, it was her very last number of the night. Barney Josephson could not imagine her following it with anything else. We'll have more music and talk about Cafe Society in just a few moments. This is David Brent Johnson, and you're listening to Cafe Society, the right place for the wrong people, on Nightlights. Society is the theme on this edition of Nightlights, New York City's first integrated nightclub, opened by Barney Josephson at the end of 1938 and the place where Billie Holiday debuted her version of the anti-lynching song Strange Fruit. Cafe Society struggled financially for the first year of its existence, and Josephson survived partly through loans from John Hammond and Benny Goodman. Eventually, he hit upon the idea of opening another Cafe Society, this one in Uptown Manhattan, with the notion of then closing the downtown club. The Uptown Club was more elegant, less popular front in its aesthetic and atmosphere, but it was a hit with a sophisticated New York set, and its success sent more and more clubgoers down to the original Greenwich Village venue. Suddenly, Josephson was operating two very financially successful establishments, and that trend would continue throughout the World War II years. Here's a live broadcast of Count Basie's big band at Cafe Society Uptown in 1941.
We're at Cafe Society, but we're jumping at the Woodside.
Thank you. come to the end of 15 minutes of jump music played for you by Count Basie. The streamlined rhythm and syncopation of Count Basie, his music, his piano, and his orchestra have been brought to you by Columbia from the Manhattan nightclub, Cafe Society Uptown.
Count Basie, another of John Hammond's discoveries, doing Jumpin' at the Woodside at Barney Josephson's Cafe Society Uptown in 1941. Josephson managed several of the artists who performed at Cafe Society, such as Hazel Scott and Zero Mostel, but like John Hammond, he refused to take a commission from them. Josephson's widow and co-author of his memoir, Cafe Society, The Wrong Place for the Right People, Terry Trilling Josephson.
Barney felt very strongly about the fact that you don't take money or you don't take a percentage of a person's earnings because it was sort of like buying flesh.
Josephson and Hammond each had a strong sense of ethics and also a strong sense of how the African-American artists they managed and promoted should present themselves, historian Michael McGurr.
The irony of Cafe Society is that it's founded in part as a critique of the paternalism of the very rich, and yet Josephson and his musical sidekick, John Hammond, engaged in paternalism themselves, in telling artists sometimes what they had to be, what they could sing, and what their identity ought to be. And that was exactly the kind of pretension that they criticized in The Very Rich.
Singer Lena Horne was one Cafe Society performer who bristled when Josephson tried to reshape her racial identity, urging her to inject her performances with more blues feeling. But she ultimately gave him and others around Cafe Society credit for awakening a different kind of consciousness in her. Thanks to Paul Robeson and Josh White and the whole atmosphere around Barney's club, she later recalled, I began to interest myself in matters like civil rights and equal opportunity for everyone. Like nearly all of the African-American performers who worked for Josephson, she would speak highly of him in years to come. Lena Horne and I Got a Right to Sing the Blues on Nightlights.
To sing the blues, I got a right to feel low down, I got a right to hang around, down around the river. A certain man in this old dragging my poor heart around, all I see for me is misery. I got a right to sing the blues, I got a right to moan and sigh, I got a right to sit and cry down around the river. I know the deep blue sea will soon be calling me. It must be love, say what you choose. I got a right to sing the blue sea will soon be It must be love, say what you choose. I got a right to sing the blues.
Lena Horne doing I Got a Right to Sing the Blues, recorded in 1941. Lena Horne, who was the object of Barney Josephson's unrequited love. Josh White was a Cafe Society performer who did not need any advice from Barney Josephson on how to sing and play the blues. But Josephson did help choreograph a routine to one of his songs, Hard Times Blues. Josephson had booked a young dancer, Pearl Primus. He liked to bring artistic dancers into the club, and it was one of the ways in which his presentational aesthetic marks him as a sort of pioneer of multiculturalism. One of Primus's dances was called Slave Market, which portrayed the slave custom of singing spirituals as a secret code. Here's the Josh White song she did a dance to at Cafe Society, Hard Times Blues on Nightlights.
Went down home about a year ago. Things so bad, Lord, my heart was sore. Folks had nothing, was a sin and a shame. Everybody said hard time was a blame. A great God Almighty, folks feeling bad, lost everything they ever had. A great God Almighty, folks feeling bad, lost everything they ever had. Sun was a shining 14 days and no rain. Horn and plan was all in vain. Hard, hard times, Lord, all around. Meal barrels, empty crops burnt to the ground. Well, the great God Almighty, folks feeling bad, lost everything they ever had. A great God Almighty, folks feeling bad, lost everything they ever had. Skinny looking children, bellies poking out. That old Pellegrini without a doubt. Old folk hanging round the cabin door. Ain't seen times as hard before. Well, the great God Almighty folks feeling bad, lost everything they ever had. The great God Almighty folks feeling bad, lost everything they ever had. I went to the boss at the commissary store. Folks all starving, please don't close your door. Want more food, a little more time to pay. Boss man left and walked away. A great God Almighty, folks feeling bad, lost everything they ever had. A great God Almighty, folks feeling bad, lost everything they ever had. Landlord coming round when the rent is due. You ain't got the money, take your home from you. Take your mule and horse, even take your cow. Says, get off of my land, you're no good, no how. A great God Almighty, folks feeling bad, lost everything they ever had. A great God Almighty, folks feeling bad, lost everything they ever had.
Folk blues singer Josh White doing Hard Times Blues, recorded in 1941, and a song he played at Cafe Society to the accompaniment of an interpretive dance from Pearl Primus. Throughout the 1940s, Barney Josephson continued to promote both noted and up-and-coming artists at both of his Cafe Society clubs. Here's Sarah Vaughan doing a breakthrough song that she recorded while she was working at Cafe Society, If You Could See Me Now, on Nightlights.
If you could see me now, you know how blue I've been. One look is all you need to see the mood I'm in. Perhaps then you'd realize I'm still in grave and trying awfully hard to make my tears behave. But that's quite impossible. I'm still in love with you. You happened my way on some memorable day, and the month will be May. For a while I'll try to smile, but can I play the without my heart behind the smile? The way I feel for you I never could disguise. The look of love is written plainly in your eyes. I think you'd be mine again if you could see.
Singer Sarah Vaughan and If You Could See Me Now, recorded in 1946 around the time that Vaughan was gigging at Cafe Society. The winds of post-World War II change were not kind to Cafe Society. The Soviet Union, America's ally during the war, was suddenly its foe, and those who had been active in the popular front culture of the late 1930s and early 1940s now came under intense suspicion, with dire professional and personal consequences for many. Barney's older brother Leon, passionately committed radical, had been involved in underground left-wing activity, and in 1947 he was called before the House Un-American Activities Committee, where he refused to testify. He was sent to prison in Michigan as a result, and Cafe Society came under FBI surveillance. Barney Josephson resisted calls to repudiate his brother, even as media mavens such as Walter Winchell began to attack him relentlessly.
Dorothy Kilgallen, Louise Sobel, all the Hearst papers, Westbrook Pegler was a big one. You know, these were people whose words were on the radio, which went throughout the country. Millions and millions of people read their columns and listened to Winchell on radio. And this was really what these were people who were instrumental in having the clubs really closed.
Even some of Josephson's former Cafe Society artists, such as Hazel Scott and Josh White, would eventually repudiate him in testimony before the House Un-American Activities Committee. Josephson became the only blacklisted nightclub owner, finding himself with the same unwanted designation that now dogged many of the entertainers that were his friends and former employees. Although blacklisting and media attacks played an important role in ultimately undermining Josephson, Michael McGurr cites another reason for Cafe Society's demise in the late 1940s.
Cafe Society was very much of its moment and its time. It emerges in the late 1930s at the high point of swing music, at the high point of the popular front, and it didn't really adjust. In the 1940s, bebop emerges, this new form of African-American music, and John Hammond didn't particularly like bop, and Cafe Society didn't touch it. And in that sense, the clubs didn't follow where black culture was going. And I think that's one of the reasons why, along with political trouble and financial trouble, the uptown and downtown cafe societies faded away in the late 1940s.
The culture of the late 1940s took a devastating financial toll on both Cafe Society uptown and downtown. And by 1948, Josephson was forced to sell both establishments.
Barney was totally and utterly devastated when he had to close the club. They were his life. They were the ultimate point in his life, that they were everything he wanted of life or out of life. So that he was totally devastated, totally. However, he, being the kind of person he was, he recovered enough to start a little business, a restaurant business.
Barney Josephson would bounce back with his restaurant, The Cookery, and in the 1970s, he began to feature musical artists there as well, including some of the same performers who had once starred at Cafe Society. Josephson passed away in 1988 at the age of 86, and to the end of his life, Terry Trilling Josephson says, his eyes would light up whenever he talked about his landmark club, where music, civil rights, politics, and the arts all converged to create one of the most vital cultural night spots the world had ever seen.
It was a moment in his life that would never go away and which lived with him all the time. Even many, many years when he just never spoke about it. It was a culmination of an incredible dream, which one could hardly expect to have been so successful in.
Cafe Society, to me, is a great reminder that art, music, culture do have political significance and political meaning, and that they can't be understood in a vacuum apart from the society that created them. And you see very clearly with the history of these two clubs that connection, and it's an important one to bear in mind. On the broadest level, Cafe Society is a reminder then of the social context of music. In terms of a moment in time, it's a reminder of how deeply felt racial issues were beginning to be in the United States. It's a sign that Americans were not going to put up with segregation and the oppression of African Americans much longer.
We close with Big Joe Turner and Frankie Newton doing a live performance of On the Sunny Side of the Street at Cafe Society in 1939. Thanks for tuning in to this edition of Nightlights. Special thanks to Michael McGurr and Terry Trilling Josephson. You can listen to this and many other Nightlights programs and view playlists, jazz news, and commentaries on our website at wfiu.org/nightlights. Production support for this program comes from the Laughing Planet Cafe and Soma Coffee House and Juice Bar, located on the corner of Kirkwood and Grant in Bloomington, Indiana. Nightlights is engineered and produced in the studios of WFIU in Bloomington, Indiana. This is David Brent Johnson wishing you good listening for the week ahead.